The Carla Show, Firefighters Edition, Episode 2.
The Carla Show.
We've known each other for a number of years. Things didn't really start hitting until 2011. There's so much, I don't even know where to begin. It was the craziest thing. That one night, I will never forget it. I'm sleeping, and I woke up, and I was in that building. I was in that building again. The smells, the feel of the heat, the smoke, and just my walls were that floor. That one night going to sleep, opened up Pandora's box. I can't tell you how many different things around me trigger a memory from that. Unfit for firefighting, unfit permanent.
Welcome to The Carla Show for First Responders, Firefighters Edition. Are you suffering with PTSD, or do you know someone who is? How do you know if you have PTSD? Listen in and hear from firefighters who share their never-before-told stories with Carla. Find hope and guidance that will improve your life. Please welcome your host, clinical therapist and radio show host, Carla Lundblade.
Hello and welcome. I'm Carla Lundblade. I'm not only your radio show host, I'm a first responder PTSD expert, a clinical therapist, and the daughter of a retired California Highway Patrolman. I am part of the first responder family, and I'm so happy that you've joined us today. If you are a firefighter, this show is for you. If you are a family member of a firefighter, you should give a subscription to this show as a gift. I believe every firefighter family in America should be subscribed to my show because I am your one-stop shop for PTSD awareness, training, prevention, education, and treatment resources and referrals. First responder PTSD can be treated, and I can prove it. On last week's show, I had a wonderful interview with retired fire captain Steve DeMartin, and we talked about the national statistics that almost 50% of firefighters experience PTSD. And almost 50% have had thoughts of suicide. That's crazy to me. But my statistics show something different. An astounding 94% of firefighters surveyed experienced PTSD. And when you think about 94% of firefighters having PTSD, you must also think about the fact that 95% of departments still do not provide peer support or family support for PTSD or its depression or suicide prevention programs. This is important, and I'll tell you why. Even if you just look at the national statistics, let's just throw mine out the window. They also say that 16% of American firefighters have attempted suicide. Now, we know with the national numbers that most of those suicide attempts have been survived, and in all likelihood, their families are not even aware of the suicide attempts. Now, brace yourselves. That means 182,000 firefighters across America have attempted suicide, most likely because of PTSD. And you are also probably aware that a first responder commits suicide once every 18 hours. And these statistics are breaking records. And that's just not okay. And that's why I'm here. On today's show, we're going to be talking about the real truth about PTSD and your rights when you're seeking treatment. We've got Jimmy Sands on the show today. He's taken the 40 symptom assessment. He has 30 of the symptoms and he's cycled through those. You're going to want to hear this interview. If you are a spouse, you are definitely going to want to hear this interview. But we'll be talking about that at length and what your real rights are and what the things are that you're going to need to be aware of. So I'm going to be a little detail-oriented there. I hate doing that to you, but it's stuff you absolutely need to know before you seek treatment. So bear with me. I promise you it'll be worth it. The first things, first and foremost, I want you to get these 2 points. PTSD is natural and normal. And a response to extreme circumstances. It is not an indication of mental weakness or mental illness, and PTSD is treatable. Now, I can give you statistics from the National Institute of Health and the National Institute of Mental Health, but basically what they say is when we take pictures of the brain and we see how the brain operates before treatment and after treatment, we can tell by the brain patterns that show up on a camera that PTSD is either cured or treated and minimized. So we know this stuff works. We also know that there are 3 proven solutions that work in PTSD treatment: mental health care training, education, and peer support. And you get all 3 of those here at The Carla Show. So here's the big deal that you need to hear. When you're seeking PTSD treatment, beware of using your EAP program or your health insurance. Most firefighters and their families believe that their medical records are completely private and protected by HIPAA. They are not. That is completely wrong. And what I want you to know is that your medical records may not be protected if you ever have an incident on duty, an injury, an accident, anything like that on duty, and there's a lawsuit, your medical records will be opened up. And that's when your department's going to find out about your PTSD diagnosis, which could affect your promotional opportunities and your ability to work. Your solution before the Carla Show is that you take charge of your privacy and mental health care by private paying, which means that you don't bill your insurance. You pay out of pocket. Now, the benefit to doing that is that your therapy sessions do not become part of your permanent medical record. So if you ever have an incident on the job, this will not come up in your records. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but diagnosis is only required for medical billing to insurance companies. So a practitioner does not even have to diagnose you or make it even a part of your record. So the good news about that is nobody up the chain of command will find out. But the downside is huge. Private pay PTSD mental health care, the cost can be quite significant. And even if you just take the averages, which people do better doing more than what the average suggests, but let's just take the averages. Over the course of a year, the total cost would average about $7,200 out of your pocket. And that breaks down to $138 per hour session. And you must also really keep in mind that there are no educational benefits or peer support program add-ons to this kind of PTSD treatment. So you're only achieving at best 33% of your potential PTSD therapy effectiveness with private pay in-office mental health care. So that's why I'm here, and that's why I have a solution that works for everyone anywhere. In what I hope is a groundbreaking move, the Carla Show for First Responders Firefighters Edition provides you with over 52 clinical hours of PTSD mental health care education and peer support for a yearly price of only $360. Now that's $30 per month for 12 months, which is a cost savings of 95% on your PTSD treatment training. That's a cost that when you sit with me for an hour, it costs you $6.92 for my clinical hour instead of $138. There's some other benefits I want you to know. It provides a complete 100% potential effectiveness incorporating all three modes of those proven treatments. It also provides complete anonymity and access wherever and whenever you choose without having to visit a clinician, which I'm sure you know is a mandatory reporter. There are no office visits. There's no PTSD diagnosis added to your permanent medical record, no health insurance company involvement, and no risk to your career. Instead, you receive proven PTSD therapy educational training and peer support with me that you can use every minute of every day to successfully treat your PTSD. So I just look at it that if you want to stop suffering, if you really want to enjoy your life, if you love your family and you want to keep them together and safe from harm, or if you want to support your colleagues, this podcast is for you. Now, I'm going to ask you to go a step further. If you are a firefighter listening to me right now, I want you to consider contacting me at Carla@CarlaLumbly.com and requesting to be a guest on my show. You are helping immensely by coming forward and telling your story anonymously. Your efforts will save firefighters' lives and allow us to stop the crippling epidemics of PTSD, of depression, suicide, and broken families for firefighters. Together, we can create a new type of PTSD treatment and peer support that works for everyone, anywhere, and at any time for a very minimal cost. I think it's time to change the lives of all firefighters and their families for the better. And I really thank you for your dedication and support, and I look forward to our interview together. And I welcome you here today, along with my very special guest, Jimmy Sands. Our interview starts now. Welcome, Jimmy.
Hi.
Glad to have you here today.
Good to be here. I love what you're doing.
So let me ask you probably the most obvious question. What's it like being here today and talking to me about your PTSD?
Well, we've known each other for a number of years, and things didn't really start, you know, hitting until 2011. So the things that affected me that led up to my retirement didn't really kick in until 2011. Where there's so much, I don't even know where to begin.
Absolutely. So when you and I were first connected, PTSD wasn't so much of an issue for you, and it gradually became a very serious issue in 2011. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, the fire was in 2007, and I didn't start having effects until 2010, 2011.
Okay.
You know, after the fire, they sent us all out to counseling, and we were offline for a couple of weeks and went back to the firehouse and stuff and went back to every day, you know, every day at the job. And so that fire was in August, and it was coming around March, that following March, walking down to the firehouse and seeing that building. I mean, it was just really messed up that the fire was right across the street from the firehouse. And seeing that building still there, it just, it creeped me out. Now, you know, when we went to counseling, we were offered transfers, you know, anywhere we wanted to go. I felt I needed to stay home with the guys because that's, you know, when you're in a firehouse, that's your family, your second family. So, you know, everybody, you hang out, you know, not at work, you hang out at work and stuff. And I felt that if I was with these guys, it was going to be okay. You know, when a situation happens, everything can get talked about it at the kitchen table, you know, while you're washing sheets or while you're going grocery shopping, you know, where you're, you know, in between runs and stuff. I thought it was going to be okay to stay. And then one day it just got uncomfortable and I didn't even really look for another firehouse or anything. I went up to the captain. I said, I got to get out of here. I explained it was about, you know, seeing that building all the time. And, you know, I put my papers in for a company. I hadn't even gone over to the company and introduced myself, basically put it in. And within a week, the transfer was approved. So, you know, I left firehouse. A bunch of the guys came out after my last tour and I started a new firehouse and started moving forward, you know. And what they tell you is it's your career. You know, it's a big world out there. So experience what you can. You know, some guys go in, they study, they get promoted, they go work in different boroughs, they, you know, go do different jobs and stuff. And I went out to Queens and, you know, I was in a neighborhood that I pretty much grew up in. And that was a bonus. The captain sent me to show up for school and everything. And, you know, things were good. You know, I had no complaints. Things didn't start really kicking in up until 2011. It was the craziest thing. You know, my wife's here with us today and she knows about the fire. That one night, I will never forget it. I'm sleeping and I woke up and I was in that building. I was in that building again. The smells, the feel of the heat, the smoke, and just my walls were that floor.
Yeah, on absolutely. Fire.
I woke up terrified, panicking. Like I couldn't understand this. And then as quick as it was like that, the walls went back to the way that they were. It was a regular house again.
Wow.
And I didn't understand it. And I brushed it off as a nightmare. I've been in the fire service between the volunteers and the career from 1996, 1997, up until when they retired me in 2014. And I've been in fires before. I've been to really horrible calls. I've seen things that I'm sure would bring, you know, somebody that you walk past the supermarket would give them nightmares for years.
Absolutely.
And I brushed it off. And those calls didn't really affect me like this thing did. You know, go back to work and everything, and now these nightmares start. And now they're consistent, and they're always like 2-3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
What they tell you to do is you go to counseling. So the job has a counseling unit, and that's what I did. I made appointments and went in and talked and stuff and went to the job psychiatrist, and they decided to start me on some meds. You know, there was no diagnosis of PTSD. It was just, you know, we got to help you. So I started taking these medications, and then some of the medications, you're not supposed to have these medications while you're working. So they took me out of the firehouse, and now I'm going light duty. So I was fortunate enough that I was able to get a nice light duty spot, and I was doing that for 24s, and then I was able to do some driving, and then that was from like 2011. We're getting into the fall. You know, I had just finished the 9/11 flag tour, and, you know, it was a lot of traveling and stuff. I mean, I think from 2007, from the date of the fire up until that tour ended, I was pretty much busy all the time. So my brain always had other things going. And when that not-for-profit and those trips stopped, I guess that one night going to sleep opened up Pandora's box about this fire.
Absolutely.
I never really forgot that day. I never do because I live it every day. It's in my head every day. It's like, I can't tell you how many different things around me trigger a memory from that. So they had decided to put me out, to retire me, unfit for firefighting, unfit permanent. And I didn't request it. The job did it. The doctors at the medical office did it. I just lost everything. I'm having nightmares. I'm going to counseling. I'm out of the firehouse. I'm on medical leave. If you look at me on the street, you think that there's nothing wrong. It's right. What happens behind closed doors when I go to sleep. It's the craziness. It's the, I'm going to make videos all day long and just have nothing else to do. I'm going to sit there and play video games. I'm going to drink my face off. And, you know, and now I'm stuck at home. I can't go to work. I'm in limbo. Guys have died since that fire. Suicide. Guys are messed up the same way. It could be very bad.
Yeah.
But fast forward to my whole life was destroyed. I had to go to the medical office and beg for a referral to go to a psychiatrist because I shouldn't have to pay out of my pocket. I got a lot of back talk from this doctor over there, and they gave me a referral, and I went and saw this lady in an hour and a half. I sat down with her, explained everything, and her words at the end of the session were, "You brought this all on yourself. So you're a professional and you're telling me that everything that's going on, my nightmares, everything that's happened in my life, that I brought this on myself," which made me, it destroyed me. I was fortunate enough to find someone that figured out what meds would help me to get myself squared away. 2012 was when all this stuff happened. So 2013, I started a bunch of different medications. And they actually made a difference. I wasn't allowed to go to work because of the medications. I was at home for a month at a time, go to the doctors and stuff. They sent me into a board. And within a week, they had a decision. The meds were working. I was definitely different. I actually packed up and moved upstate. And everything was okay. You know, with all the good things that happened, meeting my wife and moving and having a nice place and doing things that I couldn't do before. I mean, I took myself away from the city because I thought that for me to move forward, being away from the city wouldn't trigger so much.
Sure.
You know, I love going down and seeing the guys at the firehouse. I love hanging out in the neighborhood bar and seeing my friends and just jumping up and running out to a concert or something or going to a different bar or something. But for me to be down there, there was too much memory. If I hang out too long with the firemen, now I'm going to miss my job even more because I can't do it anymore because a doctor told me that I can't.
Right.
They took care of me. You know, I've got my pension. That's fine. But what this fire did was destroy my brain. It fried me. And I have to live my life vicariously through other people. Things go good for a year. And then lo and behold, now there's nothing else to do. Our flag tour is done. I'm sitting home after a year. Now I'm in the bar every day. I was able to find myself a job working for a ball team, and it was great because I treated that as like me going to the firehouse. It's something to look forward to every day.
Yeah, it gave you purpose.
Yeah, every day, and that job led into bigger responsibilities at that job, and I actually got myself thinking that that was like the firehouse. I'm working again. That's the firehouse. I'm going and I bring donuts in, I bring coffee in, you know, I bring snacks in. After all of our games and stuff, we get everybody together, hang out and drink, eat food, talk about stuff, you know, befriend all my coworkers and stuff and do that. And then everything's okay. You know, the nightmares, you know, they're there, but they're not there. They weren't there so much.
What now, a relief.
The one pill that the doctor had me on was trazodone. So I'm taking the trazodone. They upped it up to 200 milligrams because I was having such a hard time sleeping. I mean, my wife saw me in a nightmare crawling around. I was actually reliving that fire. That's something that people don't understand. I think that, you know, PTSD, whatever the event was, everybody's mind plays it out differently with them. I put a lock on my gate when I was still living in Queens because I was crawling out of the house and up the stairs to get out. Because in those dreams, those nightmares, I'm actually in it and reliving it. Heather followed me out one morning in the middle of the night. And I was in a nightmare. Like, I'm banging doors, banging windows, trying to get out. You know, while I'm sleeping, I'm in that fire. So back to the meds. The meds worked. And then the meds...
It took a long time for your meds to work. And sometimes they worked for a little bit, and then they stopped working. And there was a point where you, like, 6 months, I think, of you trying to get on the correct cocktail.
Yeah, the dosage.
There
was so many. So it wasn't immediate that you had relief.
No, definitely was not immediate.
There was a lot of trial and error, and, you know, I don't like...
And you also weren't immediately retired. You were in limbo for, like, what, a year where you couldn't work, but yet they wouldn't retire you?
Yeah, it was a year of the trying. It was a year before the trying, so it was from 2011 through 2013. So 2012 into 13, and then the whole year 2013, I was home.
Yes.
Yeah.
Carla, there's two times a year that I really, people need to understand that if I'm a little loud or I don't see myself, that's the anniversary of the fire.
And it's not just that day. It's when I first met Jimmy, I love Jimmy, obviously. I'm married to him, but I didn't understand. And obviously I will never completely understand because I wasn't there and wasn't in that situation. But I knew the date of the fire, but I didn't realize that like a month before I was like, you know, what's going on? You're not seeming yourself. And he was like, well, it's the anniversary. And I didn't understand. I'm like, now I understand, you know, it's like starting the month before that's the anniversary. And it starts before that date. It's not the day of, and it goes away. It starts the month before. And then after that date, there was still issues. I'm like, what's going on? He's like, well, now we got 9/11. So now I got to get past 9/11. Sure. And so it's a good 2.5-3 months of the year that takes a toll on him.
It's consistent.
Yes. And it's every year. And I didn't understand that. And it's hard to watch him go through that every year.
And see, this woman, you know, every couple, they have their little arguments and stuff like that. Remember that one night that
we've only ever had like maybe two.
That one night where you backed me into the corner. Remember downstairs, you backed me into the corner. I said, don't ever back me into a corner again. Yes. I almost threw her out the window because I was backed into a corner because I couldn't get out. And that's something that fire did to me, is that if I feel trapped, I'm going to do everything in my power to get out. You know, there are two buildings up here that I've gone into that I will never go into again because it reminded me of that building. Even to this day, when I go into an elevator, I think, what's the tallest building in the city here? 14 stories?
There's more than, yeah.
Well, I went into a building, an elevator. I still walk into the elevator and I stand wherever the direction of the entrance that I came in was, you know, so I know how to get out. When I stay in a hotel, you know, recently I was down in Louisiana for a friend's funeral. Rob, my buddy Rob, who's a fireman in the city too, he forgot that I have a hard time being high up. It was never like that. This is only really after the fire. As I'm getting out the elevator, of course, it had to be like a 3-minute walk to the room. I'm looking for all the ways out, and I'm tapping. This is the way out. This is the way out. I'm pre-planning my escape from that floor.
Right.
But these are all things that affect me, and people look at me sometimes that I'm crazy. When I talk to my family about stuff, and, you know, I love my family. We have a small family. I could chalk it off to age. I could chalk it off to not knowing. But there were times there was a comment made, and my brother said, no, he didn't lose everything. But you know what? We did.
Wow.
You know, when I've called my mom every day since that fire. The day of the fire, I took somebody's cell phone, civilian cell phone. I called my mother because she was home watching it on the news. My aunt and my cousin had just left the firehouse. And I'm outside talking to firemen. And I called my mom, and my mom said, promise you won't go back in there. I promise. I got to go. So she's watching this on the news, knowing that I'm in there. I called the one I got out. And of course, we tried to get back upstairs, but they wouldn't let us up because that's when the fatals and all that stuff started happening. But I've called her every day since then to let her know that I'm okay. And when I call her sometimes, she, so what's the matter? You know, I had a bad nightmare. Well, you have to let this go. You have to move on. Like, these are the responses I've got from 2012. You know, it's 2019. And I don't think my brother and sister really fully understood
right. What
this does.
Exactly.
At one point, I had enough, and I told him, I said, you know what? I call you because you watched that fire. When I call you to tell you about this, I call you because, you know, I'm venting, because some people don't want to hear. And it's not a secret. There are people that don't care to hear about this. You know, I get friends of mine that say it's mind over matter. I get friends of mine that said, I'll just move forward. I don't think they understand until they've actually been in it.
Right. They don't get it. They don't get it at all.
And that's the problem. You have percents out at the beginning of the show, suicide rates and divorce rates and PTSD and stuff and what happens and stuff. Yes, everybody looks at you different. You know, people ask why you retired. What are you, like 30, 40, 47, but I got hurt in a fire. I'm not going to sit there and explain to them. I got trapped in a fire, blah, blah, blah. Firemen that I just meet, they want to know. And if they want to hear about it, then yeah, I have no problem talking about it. One doctor had told me, out of the probably 20 or 30 doctors, that talking about it helps to desensitize you. If that's true, I have not been desensitized since 2007.
Right.
Because it's there every single day. When I'm putting my socks on in the morning, when I get in the car and I go through drive-through at Dunkin' Donuts, you know, it's always there. When I'm in the shower, I remember a moment. It destroys friendships too. I know there's people that don't want anything to do with me anymore because some people will say, oh, he's faking it. He's fine. Look at him. He's out swimming. He's drinking. I think I may be a functional alcoholic. I don't drink to get drunk. I drink because I have a social thing. I have a good time. Sometimes it happens. Sometimes it doesn't. Have I compensated for what goes through my head? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Sometimes alcohol makes me smile. It makes me happy, you know, and sometimes I'll drink and then I'll get really upset and depressed, you know, but I always look forward to the next day. I look forward to my wife coming home from work, you know, so I can go to sleep. You know, I look forward to seeing her in the morning and making coffee. Now we're scaring each other, you know, and now I'm jumping all over the place. You know, she comes out, scares me. I'm making videos, you know. I'm trying. Yeah, I'm trying all kinds of different things.
I saw one of those. It was funny.
Yeah, she just did one of me this morning before your show. But we had this conversation when I had that breakdown and I called you and I was just driving aimlessly. Remember? What was it, like 2 months ago?
Yeah. I do remember.
I was just very depressed and very, very at that point. Do I snap on friends? Do I snap on family? Do I snap on the Heather? Yeah, yes, I do. And I don't do it intentionally. It just kind of happens sometimes, you know? And there's so much that I have in my mind that I've thought about sitting down and writing it, sitting down and typing it, sitting down and recording it. But I feel like if I do that, I'm going to piss off a lot of people. I'm going to hurt a lot of people. I'm going to have a lot of people look at me like, what is wrong with this guy? These are the things that are in my head. Doesn't make me crazy. Then I go back to, why am I here? I mean, I've told Heather, let's move to Alaska.
Yeah.
Let's get out of here. Let's go out to Ontario and have a house with no neighbors. Yeah, let's move far away where nobody can visit us. And they have to like take, you know, airplanes to get in, you know, little water planes to get in and come see us. I'm open to moving and going places and just getting away and starting over. Because I kind of feel like it's not worn out welcome, but it's more like, my head is the biggest jigsaw puzzle ever created, and I don't know how to fix that. I don't know how to put it back together. I don't know where to start. I don't know how many corners there are and how many straight. I don't know.
Yeah.
What I do know is that every day there's a constant reminder of what happened in 2007 that just didn't shake. And my poor wife sometimes has to deal with that, and I hate that. I hate that she has to deal with that.
I am so glad that you and Heather are here together today, because you've painted such a beautiful and clear picture of what it's like day to day. And I think that's so important, because I know there are people all across America that go, that's exactly what it's like at home. And we don't talk to our friends about it, and nobody really knows about it. And I've got to deal with this every day, or the anniversary date's coming up. But it's, you know, like what you talked about, Heather, a quarter of the year to prepare for it, get through it, and then come out the other side. I love the fact that the two of you are here together and talking so much about what this has been like. Jimmy, let's start. The fire that you're referring to in 2007, can you tell me a little bit about that fire?
It was a Deutsche Bank fire downtown Manhattan. August 18, 2007, the call came in at 3:39 in the afternoon. The computers were down, got the verbal, put the companies out. I had the nozzle. Backup was Dave. Control was senior guy. We had a detailed chauffeur and a detailed boss. Building at that time, I believe, was 31 stories. They were deconstructing it. It was a building that was contaminated with stuff from 9/11. A few months back, they'd recently found remains on the roof from 9/11. There was smoke and fire ripping out of the side of the building, 14, 15 stories up. So we got there first, took the exterior elevator up, and basically, you know, we go to the floor below the fire, we find a standpipe, and we hook up. When we got to the first staircase, there was a standpipe, but it had garden hose attachments on it, so we couldn't use that one, and we couldn't gain entry to the floor above because it was all sealed up with plastic and heavy timber and steel. There was no way for us to get up. We went to another standpipe. It was the same thing. The truck had to come up with tools to force entry to get up there. We had no water coming in the standpipe. You know, we're up there for about 45 minutes. And at one point, one of the senior guys goes, just take some of those windows, because we had some smoke. We had a haze up there. We start breaking windows out, and fire started to drop down. Now, the building was under asbestos abatement. So there were these units like every other floor that collected all the asbestos and filtered it and stuff. And they'd pack it up or whatnot. They had these big hoses, big 5-6 inch hoses in the connected to these units that vent outside the building. At one point, you know, we had the two engines hooked up, two other engines hooked up, and the truck were trying to force entry. The boss had come over and told us to go on air. Now, I have a guy that had 4 or 5 months less than me. He put his mask on. I said, take your mask off. We don't know what's going on. We don't know how long we're going to be up here. Like, just if you need to take a hit, don't keep it on, because we don't have a lot of time in those bottles. And at one point, it got so dark, heat, fire, everything. We all started bailing out. Now, the boss wasn't with us. He left us. I was behind Dave, and I had Dave go out. We're following a wall to get back out. But as we got to a turn, the wires up top dropped down on my bottle and caught me up. So then I lost Dave. And now I'm panicking and trying to get out of that, you know, trying to cut the wire and all that stuff out. When I thrust myself out, I had no wall, no point of reference. It's hot. It's smoky. I hear the fire. I feel it on my back. Now my vibro alert starts going off, and I don't know where the hell I am. You have a certain amount of time left once that thing goes off, and that thing went off, and that was it. There were 28 Maydays in that fire, and mine was one of them. Everything happened so fast. I'm crawling around trying to find out how to go. I'm not ashamed to say it, that I definitely pissed my pants. At one point, I took my face piece off and took a really good feed of that crap, put it back on. You know, I kind of felt like my father tapped me on the shoulder, told me to calm down. That's when I was able to transmit the Mayday. They're trying to figure out where I was. I knew I was towards the Trade Center side. I start crawling a little bit, and I get to a point, and I started to go right. I still have no reference, and I decided to just, like, move straight a little bit, and I found the hoses. So I knew when we came in that that's where the way out was. So I kind of back up a little bit, and at that point, the captain for Squad 18 had grabbed me and threw me out the side of the building. So the other guys had gone left and followed the wall all the way back out. I get out, pull my helmet off, my face piece off. I'm like, I hear guys banging on the wall like Jesus. So grab a tool, we try, you know, getting the plywood out. One by one, the guys start coming out, and my backup comes out, and a senior guy, he throws us in the elevator and tells us, take him down. So, you know, we try to get back up there and stuff, and Dave and Kenny and everybody, we went down to the street. There was a picture they put in the paper of us. Dave was on O2. I'm spitting out of water out of my mouth. There's a guy helping us with our bottles and stuff. We're looking up. We wound up going to the hospital for carbon monoxide poison and smoke inhalation. We were in there for a couple of hours. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wasn't leaving until Dave was leaving. You know, I'm not going to leave the guy there. You know, they weren't letting him leave because his gas levels weren't good. My old instructor, drill instructor from Proby School, was there, and one of the guys that died, who was in detail, was from his company. He grabbed me, and we went outside to the ambulance.
Yeah.
Went outside to the ambulance bay, and we stood there as they brought one of the bodies out into the bus. I don't remember if it was Bobby or Joey, but I never thought that I would be standing in that spot. There were all of these guys in the hospital. I mean, there was a lot of guys. There had to be 100 of us in that hospital. Went back to the firehouse with Dave. Dave got out. We went back. Chief Kelty was there. He made us make sure we contacted our families and stuff. And, you know, we went home. We had to go to the medical office the next day. I went right to the bar. My brother, my sister, my brother-in-law, my friends and stuff were all in the bar. There were 2 shots in the back of the bar. You know, drank a beer. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning, drank a beer, had a shot. My brother leeches over me. He goes, you need to find a new career. I said, it's not going to happen, Mike.
Yeah.
The next day, Dave comes over to the house, and we go over to the medical office, and pretty much all of us, we were in one area. It was all hugging and where were you? All right. Stuff like that. And, you know, we did what we needed to do. We went to the firehouse afterwards. I was fortunate enough. One of the guys from my company, he got himself assigned across the street to the building. And I went in. I felt that I needed to know what happened, where I was and stuff. And I was out, actually able to get all hazmat suited up. And we went upstairs and we went to the floor. And I recorded a video of what I remember from that day, from the day, the 2-3 days before. And, We walked around, and if I told you I was 3 feet away from the side of the building from that hole, that's how crazy things are up there. That's something a lot of people don't understand too. Fire and smoke is supposed to rise. In this building, it did the exact opposite. The fire started up on 17 and 16 and sucked down because the units were pulling everything down. So the second they forced entry to the fire floor, everything sucked down onto that floor. You know, it went down as far as the 12th floor. You know, and that's something that some firemen don't understand either. I don't discriminate a firefighter, career volunteer. Career get paid, volunteer do it out of the kindness of their heart. Volunteers get really amazing training. They upgrade their training as they move on in their volunteer time. Career firefighters always getting training and stuff. This was something unlike anything a lot of guys have ever said. I mean, senior guy on the job, the guy 35, 40 years as a firefighter on the back step, he says one of the worst fires since 9/11 that he's experienced. This is a guy talking about 9/11 and comparing that job to the fire there. People don't realize how bad things get. People don't realize, you know, he's having nightmares, big deal, everybody has them. Well, no, not when your whole bedroom or your house turns into a floor that you were stuck on. Friendships were forged that still last to this time. Some friendships that were supposedly great fell apart. So be it. But that fire did a lot of stuff. I mean, a lot of guys retired because of it. Guys have killed themselves because of it. And that's what Heather was saying before. That's the memory every year leading up to it. Dealing with this trauma in my head, you know, on this thing you had talked about suicide, I don't even think about that because one, I wouldn't be around for my awesome funeral. Two, yeah, it would be great. Two, I think it would be unfair for me to leave so early because Heather gets to spend all that life insurance money. I don't get to partake in it. So that's upset.
Good thinking.
And I joke with her all the time about it. Yeah. And she doesn't like it.
But no, I don't appreciate that.
She doesn't appreciate it. But it's a lot, and it never stops.
Right.
And
it's the sense of humor. You know, my dad used to call it the cop humor, and it is. Yeah. It's the morbid humor to get through the moments and to really give yourself something to build on to survive it sometimes, because sometimes that's all you can do is survive it. So I want to ask you a couple of questions. Yeah. One is, how often do you tell that story that you just told me in that kind of detail, including the tears and the emotion with it? How often do you do that?
It's not a lot.
It's not often at all, but he does have the recording that, and I don't know when the last time you listened to it was.
I haven't heard it in a while.
But there was a certain times where he will listen to the recording of the fire and the Maydays. And
I listen to it every year once. And every year, I guess I'm kind of looking for something, you know.
But you're not actually speaking it out loud. And
no,
you know.
But I know it. But right. I guess I'm looking for something. I'm looking to hear something. I'm looking, did I do something wrong? It was something I could have caught. Was I not paying attention on the radio when they were talking?
But have you ever actually told the story like that?
I don't really talk about it unless I'm drinking.
Right.
And somebody actually asks me about it, or somebody wants to know.
Which isn't often.
I think that really illustrates, first off, how important this interview is. It's not only other firefighters that are going to hear your story, but it's other spouses and family members that are going to hear your story. And it really paints what it's like for you on the inside of your brain, how you've processed this, how extreme this situation was, how you're a hero, really, to just be walking around every day. It doesn't matter, you know, maybe how prickly you are or maybe difficult to approach at times. The fact that you're walking around, that you made it through what you did and you live with this kind of pain every day, because we're going to talk about your list of symptoms. The symptom list is 40 symptoms long. You've checked off 30. So, Jimmy, when I talk with you, and I know you have 30 out of the 40 symptoms of PTSD, you are a hero. You are my hero, and you are the hero of every other firefighter that has done this job. The fact that you can withstand that kind of pain on a daily basis, especially pain that comes to you at night when you're unaware of it, and put your head up every day, find purpose every day, really look for things that matter to other people every day, is amazing to me. And I really want you to know that. And I really want you to know that that's how I see you.
Thank you.
I appreciate you telling the story because that's the part that works on desensitizing the memory. But it takes it from the way it's stored and it moves it into a memory, like most other things from your work are a memory. Talk to me about, you know, when you look at this PTSD assessment list that I gave you, were you affected by any symptoms up until 2007? Were there one or two? Were you unaware of them or they didn't really bother you?
There was nothing.
There was nothing.
There was nothing. I mean, 9/11, you know, I lost a couple friends, 9/11. That's always it was always an emotional time of the year. I think because of my fire in 2007, it was August 18th, to get so close, you know, to having that then, and then know that 9/11 is coming, it compounded. I had nothing. I mean, I've seen really, really horrible things. You know, I've seen gunshot victims. I've seen stabbings. I've seen people hung. I've seen people wrapped up on the trains. I've seen people hit by trains. I've seen cars mangled. You know, I've cut people out of cars. I've seen so much. I've seen people die, come back, people burn, like last breath. Like none of that has ever affected me. Not one of those things have ever affected me.
The way this fire did and what happened that
and
day.
There was a thing. After the fire, I still went into fire. I still was in-house fires. I was still going on calls. I was, you know, before they'd taken me out, I was doing all kinds of stuff. I mean, we tripped over a guy's leg that had his leg sheared off in a motorcycle accident. I get on the head, and I'm holding his brain in my gloves.
Yeah.
You know, that stuff, I remember it, but it doesn't cause nightmares. It never even comes up. Like, if people ask, oh, what have you seen? You know, you want me to talk shop? Here's shop. I didn't see a whole lot, but what I saw was a lot, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it makes exact sense. And I really love the way you've told the story today. So in regards to that fire, you said since that time, there have been firefighters that were there that have committed suicide since that time. Do you have an idea about the number?
Last, I believe it's up at 5.
Wow. And those were firefighters on that job. And since that time, they've committed suicide.
Yeah. And I believe about a dozen have retired since the fire.
Okay.
See, when you're retired, it's a whole different world. What you're used to at the firehouse every day, that doesn't happen.
Right.
You hear from some of the guys, but you don't have that constant communication anymore. You talk more with the retired guys that are out there.
Yeah.
And you don't hear everything. You know, you catch things here and there. Social media has made it so you can pretty much know everything that's going on all the time. But sometimes things happen you don't know of until, you know, weeks or months later.
Those are some really important statistics. And we're going to talk about what the system was like for you, that as you started developing some PTSD symptoms and they come out of the blue and, you know, when you look at it on a timeline, way later than you would kind of expect them to. Definitely way later than I would think your department is. You know, they had some immediate response, immediate counseling and response to the event. But by the time you started having PTSD symptoms, that was well after that time, correct?
Yeah, I was also so busy in my life too.
Yeah.
You know, from 2007 up until 2011, 2012, I've traveled all over the country. You know, I always had something going on, you know. If I wasn't working, I was on a plane flying here, there, doing that flag tour and, you know, going to ball games and doing all of this really awesome stuff. So my brain was all focused on all of that. If you go to 2011, going to 2012, when that major stuff stopped and now it's back to work, that one night, that first night that nightmare kicked in, that's when everything changed.
Yeah.
And I didn't talk about it. Like I said earlier, I didn't talk about it at first. I thought it'd be okay. And then now it's consistent. I'm like, I need help. I was in relationships. I destroyed those relationships with my behavior. The drinking was out of control. I was making stupid decisions. I wasn't thinking things through. I was taking risks. I was taking chances. I was doing really stupid stuff. I was an asshole. I was mean. I was nasty. And things got worse. I'm trying to battle that, but I shouldn't be yelling at somebody because I had a bad night and I didn't sleep.
Right.
But also when you don't sleep, I mean, at one point, Jesus, I must have dropped down to 170 pounds because I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't eating. I couldn't do anything. Like, I mean, the meds, I don't like taking medication. I feel like all these different medications that I was taking screwed me up in so many different ways. This pill, you know, there's a side effect. So you need to take this pill and this pill is going to, I felt like I was a guinea pig.
Right.
for medications. Oh, we'll up this a little bit. We'll take this down. Let's stop this and try this. Like, geez, my liver has to be, you know, a disaster. You know, now it's now taking the meds and not sleeping. I don't know.
Well, you know, what you describe is even losing yourself. You don't even know who you are on the inside of you anymore. And then when it comes to the outside world, you know, where you're working, where you have purpose, that's continually changing. And then there's the, you know, the catastrophes that happen in a personal life to anyone anyway, that just happens as you live day to day. So I really appreciate you telling that story. And what I'd like to do is go over your symptom list here, because this is what I want people to really understand. Because I see your beautiful face and the Heather, as you call her, on Facebook. I love the shit you post. It's irreverent.
I just hope we don't get divorced after all of this stuff.
And I miss the boating, because I'm a boater myself. And so I loved those pictures and your friends and the frolic. But you're absolutely right. You know, if you look at you, if you're just going down the street, you would have no idea the internal emotional pain that is a natural reaction to what you've been through and to how you've dedicated your life to help and protect others. And so I think that that's really important. Now, when it comes to PTSD symptoms, any one symptom's going to change your life. Any one symptom's going to change your life. And so I'm going to read off the 30 that you've checked here. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Nightmares and night terrors. Sleepwalking, sleep fighting. Unwanted daytime memories, images, thoughts, and daydreams. Fixated or traumatic experiences living in the past. Spontaneous psychotic episodes. The world vanishes and you're suddenly somewhere else. Panic attacks. Undefined dread or fear. Avoiding anyone or anything that reminds you of a traumatic event. Physical emotional reactions to things that remind you of the event. Self-isolating. Anxiety in crowds. Despair, depression, sadness, emptiness, loneliness, inability to trust others, very reluctant to talk about event, lack of interest or motivation, relationships that were once close are now strained, emotional numbness, substance abuse, alcohol, physical fatigue, anger, irritability, hypervigilance, that's a huge one, easily startled, substance abuse, alcohol, reduced cognitive ability, poor memory, trouble falling asleep, night sweats, accelerated heart rate, question and abandon your faith, feeling of being betrayed, fear of becoming violent, anniversary reaction, adrenaline junkie. That's a pretty big list, wouldn't you say?
And I still get up every day an hour and a half before I'm supposed to be at work and do what I'm supposed to do.
How do you do that?
And bust my butt and then go home and try to go to sleep until the neighbors start scruffing like bunnies. Or Heather comes home and bumps into the bed and goes, ow, and then I'm up.
Yeah. So this is what I want other firefighters to hear. This is your list. This is your real experience. This is where one day at work affected who you are the rest of your life. As a firefighter, as a man, as a partner in a relationship, affected your future and changed who you were to who you are now. What is it? What strength in you causes you to get up every day and not say, fuck this shit?
My wife, where we live, our bills, my not sitting around, pacing around and cleaning the house for the 30th time in a week, getting out there and meeting different people and doing something different. And figuring out what's next, you know, that list. Yeah. I've experienced everything that I've checked off on that list. It's not all at the same time. They're not all of a constant, you know, it could be 1 week I feel this way and then I'm good for 2 weeks. And then one day I feel three different X marks on that paper and fast forward. It alternates, it rotates, it comes around. But the difference is, I think, is that me leaving where I grew up and me being up here, it was a much better environment for me to be in. It's not the rustle bustle of the city. So I'm not road raging with somebody on the Belt Parkway because, you know, they don't know how to drive or they go too fast and cut me off. I'm not getting pushed, you know, into a wall on a train. because people don't know how to get up early and go to work earlier instead of, you know, being all late. You know, I'm not walking into a bar at 11 o'clock at night and drinking till 4 in the morning and then going to work at 6. Bars close at 2 o'clock here. I think maybe a dozen times in the 5 years I've been up here. I've been up there past two. You know, it's responsibility. And I think if I lived in the city, I wouldn't be that responsible.
Yeah.
And also, you know, where we live, we live very comfortable.
You still deal with these things, though, here. It wasn't just leaving the city.
Yeah, I still deal with them here, but they're not as active. You know, be provoking a fight or violent. You know, somebody pushes me or I see something in the city. I'm not experiencing that here. I really don't want to beat somebody.
Yeah. You're not being triggered like that because your environment's different.
But me getting up every day, if it was just me and we weren't married, Heather, if we weren't married, I probably wouldn't pay all the bills on time. I probably wouldn't be in this place, you know, but I'm responsible for Heather. And being responsible for Heather is also be responsible for her daughter and for the grandbaby. And that we have a comfortable place and a safe place that people can come and hang out. You know, our place is a safe place.
It's a purpose.
It is a purpose. Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's a purpose. It's surrounded by pictures and memories and love and awesomeness. And that's one of my main drives for every day. And I'll continue to do that. And I'll have my days. I'll have my days where I'm miserable.
You losing that purpose, you took that so hard and it was.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That destroyed me.
It did.
But back to your original thing. Yeah, I have a purpose. You know, that's my drive. But I'm always, like you said, I'm always going to deal with this stuff. I guess it's how you manage it. And the brothers and sisters out there need to know that they are definitely not alone. You know, what I went through is minuscule to what other people have gone through. And what could be so small of an incident could be like a volcano of emotions, you know? We're not alone.
Yeah.
And, you know, the support, I think the open communication about stuff with the Heather, with my wife about this, that she knows a little bit more now than you did in the 5 years we've been together.
Yes.
Yeah. Has that been helpful, Heather?
Yes, it's been helpful. It's just hard. I don't know. I don't know how he wakes up every day and does what he does for me.
Well, I have to clean too.
Yeah. And I'm just so appreciative of him. And I don't know. He's my hero. The fact that he does get up every day and takes care of us, and he's usually 90% of the time smiling, but the 10% that he's not, it pisses me off when people are like, get over it. Or that happened a long time ago. Don't, you know, like even with just like Hurricane Sandy, you know, you got the anniversary of the fire, then you got 9/11, and then you got Hurricane Sandy. And just this past year, somebody said, you know, get over it. And that really pisses me off.
That pissed me off because I was shocked that it came like this. Hey, anybody want a cigarette? I walked outside and I left. You know, that hurt me. Because
the 10% of the time that he isn't smiling and
people
are like, that's not Jimmy, you know.
Yeah,
why are you not smiling? And
I'm contemplating changing my number. This way, I don't got to deal with anything.
Right.
And Heather's like, don't do that. Then they're going to be calling and texting me, find out if you're okay.
But it's like, then she's going to have the fallout of that.
Yes,
here's the thing. Yes, I'm the social guy. Yes, I bring everybody together. Yes, I organize things. Yes, I try to get people to have a good time. I'm sure between now and probably 3 o'clock, hey, you coming to the joint today? I don't want to drink today. I really don't. But, you know, people, I guess, from when they first meet me, and I'm not patting myself on the back, but people want to be around. They want me around. They want me to, I might say something stupid. I might look like a jackass. But, yeah, there are times that I'm not in a mood. But when I hear people turn around and tell me that you need to get over it or you need to drop this, you know what? That's something that affects me. I don't think about it all the time because I'm not there. But, you know, some people think just because I'm happy, that Heather's happy, that we don't have things that we're dealing with, you know.
Yeah.
I'm just saying you're allowed to have that 10% time.
Yeah, well, God forbid I have it and, you know, people get upset with it.
So let me ask you a question, because this is really good for everybody to know. If I were to ask you, what things should people actually say to you? Say to you as a couple, say to you to show respect for the service that you've given the rest of America. What is it they could say to you that would actually make you feel better and supported? Or maybe we should start with a list of the stuff they shouldn't say.
I don't want anybody to say anything. I don't feel I want anybody to say anything. I have some people that say, thank you for your service. Thank you. That's great. But what people shouldn't say, you don't look like you're anything's wrong with you. You know, that right there, that's the worst thing that you could probably say to somebody that feels the way that I do. You don't look like anything's wrong with you. You don't know what goes on when I walk out of the bar, when I get out of my car, when I walk into my house.
Right.
You don't know that I've had to create routines. But I've created certain routines of things that I do every day to help me.
Yeah.
What's wrong with me is I run around with a vacuum. I buy cases of carpet cleaner at a time and blast the whole house. My wife has migraines. I didn't know that they affected her that much with her migraines. I have air fresheners all over the place. I'm always washing dishes. I'm always straightening up. I'm doing what I can. I'm doing laundry. I'm dusting. I call a committee work like we did in the firehouse. You know, When the grandbaby stays over, Heather has clothes and the grandbaby's pack and play. And when she's not here, I go around and I pick things up and I put them away. I've washed clothes for you. But that's just me and my routines of I want everything to be in some kind of order. I was never like that. I was never so crazy like I am right now. I got a big closet and all my T-shirts are hanging on hangers.
Yeah.
Every T-shirt that I own, and there's got to be 200-300 of them all on hangers.
It's good for me, though, that he vacuums, because I hate to vacuum.
Yeah, but they were color-coded. At one time, I had everything color-coded, and I pull away from
that. He does have the bigger closet.
Yeah.
You know, but what's wrong with me, I don't even know where to begin.
What are some other things that people have said that were pretty terrible for you?
Huh. I've had these little assholes up here on social media that have said stuff, and there was also someone else that passed some comments that was watching me while I was, like, you know, typing stuff. I don't take much of that to heart because they're dumb little assholes and they don't know anything, and they'll never be in a situation like pretty much 90% of career first responders are in.
Right. Right.
The worst that said to me was, you don't look like there's anything wrong with you. That's the worst that was said to me.
Yeah. What is, in those moments where you're not smiling, Jimmy, and it's a moment that may be painful for you, and somebody can say something either in support of you, you know, it doesn't have to be like real serious or a real deep conversation. What are some things that people can say at any time that really make you feel supported and, you know, that they're there for you, not there triggering you, even though they're not intending to?
There's really nothing. You know what I look forward to? The Heather calling me up and saying, hey, babies, or hey, I think we have a Shameless to watch. You know, I don't need anybody to say anything to me. I have my wife. And there's little things that go on between us that she says that totally calms me down, no matter how grumpy I am.
Yeah.
No matter how depressed or sad I am.
Heather, if I was to ask you the same question, What are things that you think strangers or acquaintances, or, you know, sometimes family's the worst at saying stuff that hurts you bad. What are some things that you'd like people to know, like things they could say where you would feel supported and not hurt so much by a comment that was hopefully meant to help you?
What are some things they could say?
Yeah.
I think it's more about what they shouldn't say, I think. I mean, you know, every year on the anniversary, Jimmy will take up the pitchers and lay out a shot for the guys.
Well, we stopped that, remember?
Yes. But before, when we would do it, you know, I just feel like, I don't know, people just saying, you know, what they, I don't know. I think not saying, or just respect, like when you, I don't know, just not saying get over it. I think that that's
Yeah, get over it, you know.
To not say that or to get over it. Maybe, yeah. Just to listen to what Jimmy has to say, and when he does happen to talk about it, which isn't very often.
Yeah. So, Jimmy, let's talk about how the process of therapy went, because in the opening of the show, I talk about some things that are really critical in relation to your career and a PTSD diagnosis that can really affect your career in a negative way and go up the chain of command. I think you have a very personal and very real story about how that went for you. So you had a full career, and when you began to have your first symptom, which was a nightmare, that was a night terror, that was your first symptom. At one point, or at some point during that, during when that was happening, you decided to seek therapy, or therapy was required for you. Can you begin at that point and kind of how that happened, and then what your experience was with therapy and the support, your career support from that point?
I went on my own because things weren't right, and I needed help. You know, I've tried to handle everything myself. You know, I've had friends that would give me bad advice, or friends that say, you need to do this. I had one friend that I was friends with for a long time, and when I was such a disaster, I didn't go to his wedding. We haven't spoke since. And it wasn't my fault. I was bringing up things that happened years before I even got into the fire service, things that happened growing up, things up to that point. And that fire and that call, it takes a lot. It's a lot. And I know that people don't understand it. Multiple doctors. And then I find out that the doctors I'm talking to aren't even really doctors. They're social workers. You know, and they refer me to another place. And then here, go to the talk to this one. And then sitting down with a shrink for the job. And, you know, we're going to do this. We're going to do that. We're going to do this. And go talk to this one. Like, they're not helping me. I didn't get the help that I needed. They didn't know how to help me. You know, it was so quick to just, here's a pill. If I told you I went to the doctor twice a week for a year and there was any kind of help, there wasn't. It didn't do anything except make me look like a crazy son of a bitch.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I found the one doctor out in Long Island that started me on one pill, and she started me out on anxiety medication. That calmed me down a lot because I was a basket case. And started me on the other pills as well. You know, it was the first the anxiety, and then it was the antidepressant and the antipsychotic. That is what helped me.
What about that lady that said it was your fault? When did you see her?
That was in the end of December of 2012, right after the shootings, after the 12/24 shootings.
Yeah.
You know, it just. I had found things to do when I woke up from the nightmare if I wasn't sleeping. Messing around with pictures on the computer, making videos, listening to music. I once got in a car and drove halfway to Ohio from New York City. I didn't even realize I was doing it. I was in Ohio, like, what the hell is going on here? Turn around and drove back.
Yeah.
You know, these medications really, part of my French, fucked me up. Yeah. And the doctors weren't helping me. So I found the one psychiatrist out in Long Island that got me on these meds, and they started working. Now I'm able to focus, and I'm not doing these stupid things anymore.
Did you find her? So
I found her.
And before, they were just sending you.
Yeah, it was through the counseling unit, and they were having you go to these different doctors.
And it was the counseling unit related to work.
It was the job. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, they do a great job. But I've also told guys that are going through stuff, do not go to them. Do not talk to them. And I told other fighters, do not talk to counselors in your job, because they're going to do to you what they did to me, what they do to other people. Go find a doctor outside, pay out of pocket, and talk about what's going on in your world, because I do believe that employment does hold that against you now. I mean, look at New York State. New York State is a red flag law state. So if somebody gets mad at me tomorrow and they turn around and say, hey, Jimmy Sands has firearms, and I think he could hurt people. Now, I doubt that they would enforce it. But now in the state, PD or sheriffs or troopers can come, bang down the door, no warrant, take your weapons.
But we do have a friend.
We do have a friend.
Who that happened to?
Yeah, we do have somebody that happened to, because he's retired from the military, 100% disability, PTSD. And they've actually taken his guns. He's had 30, 60, 90 days to surrender his firearms, or he was going to be arrested, yada, yada, yada. So the PTSD designation, do I want to take my Second Amendment right, weapons and go out and go kill people? No. I'm depressed and suffering PTSD because of a fire.
Right.
And I think that's another reason why a lot of guys don't want to talk to doctors that are having trouble, is that they're scared of the retaliation. And the retaliation, I'm not saying about firearms, I'm saying from employers, I'm saying from the job, from bosses, from coworkers. Retaliation is real in the first responder world. Look, I'm out now, so I can say what I want.
Yeah.
And I could really care less what people think about what I have to say. But if you brothers and sisters out there are having a problem, you need to find somebody to talk to. Don't go through your job. Don't take the medications. Something that's come out recently is that CBD oil, that hemp oil. If I told you right now that if I had that available to me back in 2007, 2008, I'd probably still be on the job. But I can't live in that probably would be, because I never would have met my wife. I wouldn't be where I am right now if it wasn't. You can't live in the past, but I do live in the past sometimes. But that stuff has made a world of change as far as every day. And I think it's better than taking the pills. I mean, I'm down to two pills now compared to six or seven different pills in the morning and at nighttime. I take that hemp oil from the store, from Amazon. I take it once in a while during the day if I need it for pain or just if I'm anxious. And I take it at night before I go to sleep, and it helps me go to sleep, But finding a doctor is key. You got to find somebody, and it's going to suck. You might find one person and you don't feel anything. And I understand that it's going to be hard to sit down there with another person. And by the time you found one person, it took me almost 2 years to find somebody. I had to revisit every single horrible, miserable, unfortunate, happy, amazing moment in my life to 7, 8, 9 different people.
And then you had to redo it again once you moved here.
And then I had to redo it again because I found a doctor up here that I was able to talk to. And then I went to twice a week, and then once a week, and then once a month, and then didn't have to really go in unless I actually needed to. But I can call and say, I need to come in, and I can go in. Mm-hmm. My regular medical doctor has been giving me my scripts for one of my pills because he did that before he became a medical doctor. He was a psychologist first, so he was able to get me that. And that's a big stress because now I don't have to go find a psychiatrist and go relive everything all over again. Plus, where I live, I can't afford to drive down to New York City.
Sure.
To go see a doctor once a month to get medication, but I don't want to take the medication. It's crazy, Carl. It's crazy, I tell you.
Yeah, it's definitely crazy because it's what you have to do to get care and how much your job is at risk when you do. So it makes perfect sense why first responders don't want to talk about their PTSD and try to pretend it's not there or try to white knuckle the symptoms that they're experiencing. What I'd like you to do, too, is if you can talk to me, I really appreciate you talking about CBD oil. There's a lot of great research as to CBD and how that affects PTSD and also anxiety. And there's independent research out there. And in fact, even the national governmental sites may also have some really good information there on where CBD oil helps. Can you tell me what medications worked for you and really helped with your symptoms?
It was the buspirone, buspar, the trazodone, the olanzapine. Those worked great for a long time. The trazodone we had to stop because of a side effect of that medication over 100 milligrams. It's very uncomfortable. And then there was the battle to how do I go to sleep. The olanzapine, it dragged me out. I when I'd wake up in the morning, I felt like I drank for a week straight with that cocktail of meds. The boost bar, Boosperone, whatever you call it, that helped really good with the anxiety. So I take 60 milligrams of that a day in the morning and at nighttime to help me through. But with the hemp oil that I got off of Amazon, a buddy of mine who was a ranger in the Army, he suggested trying this stuff. We both tried the same things. I found that the oil works very well. And the boost bar, that was enough for me to keep me where I am right now.
And so your goal is always to take as little as possible to feel as good as you possibly can, right?
Yeah, I don't want to. Yeah, I mean, I'm still recovering from the back surgery, so I'm still fat and I can't get to the gym and get skinny again. And I'm miserable inside about that. That's another thing. I have to deal with that on a regular basis. But I make jokes about it. You know, you might call me, man, you're fat. You got to do something. You know what? Screw you. I wish I could. I can't. I'm not allowed. I'm not cleared for PT yet. You know, that's something that's ongoing. That adds to the regular stuff. But I don't like to take pills. I find myself taking Aleve for my back issues, but I don't want to take pills. Now, in the last couple of weeks, I've started having these panic attacks. They last anywhere from 30 to 40 minutes to an hour. Something just happens, and I don't know what it is. I feel restless. My heart rate goes through the roof. I'm breathing really fast, really heavy. You know, I try to figure out what to do. I get up. I go jump in the shower. You know. I have four or five cigarettes, and I'm trying to find a way. I go take some of that oil. Well, now I found that when I feel like that in the last couple of weeks, I go play my video games, and then I just lay down and go to bed. So I mean, I don't know. There's just so much stuff going on, but that oil has really helped out tremendously.
So I want to ask both of you this question. And, you know, as we finish here today, there have been amazing things that you've talked about and really opened up the world of what it's like, even minute by minute, dealing with PTSD and trying to get better with PTSD over time. Jimmy, if you had a message for other firefighters out there and family members, support people, you know, like what Heather has been for you, what do you want them to know?
As difficult as it may sound, husbands, wives, boyfriends, girlfriends, sisters, brothers, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents, everybody, if you're a first responder, son, daughter, if they're going through something, you need to listen to what they have to say. You can't turn around and tell them, hey, it'll get better over time. It doesn't work that way. I am certain that where we are right now, that I will always feel this way. I will always have these feelings that I can take the oil. I can occupy my mind with all kinds of stuff. I can do projects. I can do fundraisers. I can find jobs. It's always going to be there. And something that, yeah, I have to live with the rest of my life. But what everybody should know is that their families, you need to sit down and talk to them, explain to them what you're feeling. If they can't handle it, then they can't handle it. You don't want to have a family dinner and then talk about something tragic. Somebody might not be able to hear about that, but for this person to be able to get the point across that, yeah, I have issues and this is what's bothering me. And here's something that's, you know, what I saw, you know, I found a child dead, or there was this fire and it looked like this and that. If the family members can't listen to that, so be it. But understand that they're going to need help in other ways. Be there for them when they're having a bad day. There's nothing wrong with a card. Once in a while, Heather makes a card out of nowhere. You know, she'll leave messages on the mirrors with the chalk markers or something. That helps me through. She wrote a message on the mirror. I swore she wrote it twice, but I think you did two of them. But I saw that and it warmed my heart, because when I come out, that's what I see. In the morning in my mirror, I have love you babies. I see that. And in her bathroom, because we have separate bathrooms because that's how we roll, there's a picture of me and her that she wrote my favorite. And then she took it off. And I don't know why you erased
my
favorite.
The picture's still there.
The picture's still there. But family members need to do what they can to help their first responder or their family member that's having trouble. You know, a card, a note, something. You know, surprise trip. You know, she took me to see Star Trek Orchestra. I was like a little kid. I cried the whole time.
So,
you know, even so much as sitting down and watching a TV show together, binge watching a TV show, which we do all the time. And we have date night, date days.
If he's having a bad day, I will try and do little things. And it's just little things. It's because the thought that counts, you know, just let him know that I'm here for him. And I know that he's having a bad day. So I have a huge mirror that's in the hallway. So when he came out of the bedroom in the morning, I had a note that, you know, said, I know things are rough right now, but it will get better. Something to that effect. Yeah. And that I love our life together and that I appreciate all that you've done for me. You know, just little things like that to try and try and help. I can't fix it. I can't fix him. He is who he is because of all of this, and I don't want to, but some know that I'm here for him.
Well, you cut me off when I'm at the bar, so yeah, you're trying to fix me.
No, I'm trying to fix it. I'll help myself in that one.
Very true. If you could speak to a firefighter who might be suspecting that they're having some issues and not knowing where to turn at the beginning, or could speak to a firefighter that is wanting to help with a colleague, what would you want them to know?
That they're not alone. And that if they need to talk, they need to talk about what's going on. You know, nobody should think about ending their life. Nobody should think about jumping off a bridge. Nobody should think about shooting themselves. Nobody should think about hanging themselves. Things are not that bad that you have to end your life, because I'm a firm believer that, you know, when it's your time, it's your time. I will always wonder why I survived that. When I feel that way, I think about everything from that point on, what I've experienced, what I've done, who I've met, where I've gone, what I look forward to doing.
How many lives you've touched.
How many lives I've touched, how many people I've pissed off. I mean,
I meant in the good way, too.
It is. I mean, I piss people off and people.
You make a lot of people happy.
Thank me for things. But they're not alone, and then they need to find some kind of an outlet. Going to the gym and picking things up and putting them down is going to help, then do it. If running's going to do it. I mean, I guess I found helping out with charity events and getting things squared away, you know, getting different things set up or doing something out of the ordinary, getting a whole bunch of people together. If that's something that you can put your energy into, yeah, because if you do that, you might be able to find somebody that will listen to you. And you need to make good decisions too.
Heather, if you were talking to a spouse of a firefighter that is concerned for the safety and noticing some symptoms of PTSD and maybe worried that they might be considering suicide, but not knowing how to have that conversation, what advice would you give?
Oh, I have no idea. You know, when I met Jimmy, he already knew that he had PTSD. And so I think my situation's a little different in the fact that he already had it and he admitted it and it was very open. I have no idea how I would deal with it because
it's something new. And that's the thing too. Some people might not know what to do because a lot of people are under the misconception that PTSD is just people coming back from war, when it's not. It's a police officer rolling up to a car crash at 3 o'clock in the morning with people ejected out of the car. You know, it's a fireman that goes to an EMS call. The whole family is sitting there watching you try to save someone's life, and they've just died, and they're begging you to keep going. They don't know that something like that can affect them. The spouses don't know how to react. And that's something that, like I said before, Heather said as well, the little things. It's little things like that. But it's also up to the first responder, the fireman. They have to talk to their spouse. They have to talk to their girlfriend, their boyfriend, their best friend. They have to talk to them and let them know what's going on. And if they want to help, then they'll ask, how can I help? I contemplated taking Heather to the doctor with me so she can hear everything. But we're kind of doing it right now because this stuff you didn't know.
And I was open to doing that.
Yeah, so, you know. But like this stuff that you didn't know, you know, right. Seeing the checklist shit.
Right.
So, you know, whether I mask it well, that's what you need. You know, that's what the spouses have to do for each other. If they're together for the rest of their lives, then they need to be with each other. And if you have a separated family, so to speak, you know, if that's the reason for a separation or divorce, listen, you need to listen to what's going on here. You know, this is probably why our relationship is failing. It's falling apart because of what's going on with me. It's not you, or I've made mistakes because of this and this. And, you know, you can put the blame wherever you want, but this PTSD, I'm going to call it bullshit because I think it's ridiculous that it's coming out now and everybody's suffering this, because I think everybody's brains are different. everybody processes things differently. People need to understand that this is not something fake. This is something so serious. If I didn't have Heather, I probably wouldn't be here because I probably would have drank myself to death in New York City. Yeah. You know, I would have ended up in a coffin, casket, whatever you call them these days. But, you know, it's just there's people out there. And Carla, what you're doing right now, asking for people, what the boss, his recording that I heard this morning, letting people know that they're not alone, that's great, because that could get people to get out there and get help. And then now we can see if somebody's having a problem. You know, I know a friend of mine that I know is going through something, and I'm trying to get in there and find out what's going on. They're not ready to talk yet.
So what's it been like to talk with me today, to go through an assessment, to talk as a couple about what you talk about so beautifully, Heather? I love how you say doing the little things, because what the two of you have done so beautifully, and I don't know if you realize this, is you've realized that this is maintenance, that it's never over. It may transition, it may ebb and flow, but it's maintenance as you would maintain any other part of your life or your health. Maintaining having PTSD and dealing with the symptoms on a daily basis and really treasuring your partner as you go through these things is really important. So what's it been like to actually be as a couple today and to talk about this stuff more openly? I did cry over here. I wasn't going to cry on the microphone, Jimmy, because you said we'd all cry, but I did cry. And so we've all cried today. Talking
yeah.
about,
all three of us have, yeah.
Yes, talking about the real emotional things, the real things that happen. So what's it been like talking to me today and opening up about this? Like, Heather, what did you learn today that you didn't know before about Jimmy or about PTSD?
We've never actually gone through the entire fire together. I mean, I've heard, you know, the recording of it, but he's never actually just came out and told me the entire thing. And honestly, I've never actually asked. I didn't want to intrude, I guess. I didn't want to.
The way you saw, you were treading calmly, stepping slowly, because you didn't know what the response was.
Yeah, I didn't know if he wanted me to ask. I didn't know if he wanted to tell that story. So that
happens when you unfollow your husband on Facebook.
I really liked hearing it. And I don't know. I guess my heart is warm and full of love right now. I feel closer. Stop it. I feel closer to Jimmy. And I really enjoyed the conversation. I think that I learned a lot today. I learned more about you. I learned more about us and our love for each other. And I like that.
Oh, sounds like I performed a little marriage counseling here today, too.
If we need that, we're in trouble.
Jimmy, what's it been like for you today to share a story that you don't share very often and to really open up about what it really is like for you?
Don't be mad. I don't feel any different than I did before we started. And the reason I say that is because this is what I live with. Yeah. This is what I've been accustomed to. This is, you know, the occasional talking about that stuff. You know, I could sit here with you and Heather for hours and talk about every single thing that's gone on. It would take hours, if not weeks, if not months. Do I feel it helped me? It helped me a little bit. But I know, you know, at the end of the day, there's a chance that I might have a nightmare tonight and I got to get up tomorrow morning because I got to go help a buddy out. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think we had this conversation when I was talking to you when I was driving the night. I just kind of feel that everybody's brain is different. Maybe mine isn't ready yet. You know, when I take that oil, I have some wacky dreams. I will take those wacky dreams over the nightmares any day of the week.
Yeah.
And if anything, they're funny, you know, and not violent or mean, but they're actually comedy, like things thrown together in one sequence. Like the one I had last night, I was carrying a tree and we were trying to put this tree into a wall. That was the wacky dream that happened last night.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I love to hear that in talking about this openly, that it doesn't cause any damage or it doesn't cause any regression in PTSD. I really appreciate having these honest conversations about the events that really happen. They bring them to the forefront of your brain, which on one hand, as a therapist, I know is really therapeutic, but on the other hand, I know that it can bring up symptoms. And so as a therapist, I got to tell you, I feel really great about the fact that you said, no effect. I feel good. I feel like I've done my job. I feel like I've protected you. We've talked openly and honestly. We've had conversations that I know other first responders and firefighters are going to hear across the nation. You know, Heather, there's going to be people that'll say, you know, I heard Heather on that recording and this is what she said. So you've become a trademark name right there. Jimmy and Heather, I thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks, Carla.
Thank you, Carla.
And to all of our listeners, please tune in next week for our next incredible guest on The Carla Show for First Responders Firefighters Edition. Please go to carlashow.com/firefighters and click subscribe to premiere. You'll be glad you did. Here are a few highlights. Let's talk a little bit about your symptoms.
There's something wrong with me and everybody can see it. Maybe we have to have a disorder to even be in the business. Is this problem gonna be there? You know, and it's always the problem. It was my reality. Waking up in a state that you are suffering in a way that only you know, consumed by psychological troubles or the junk I've seen over the past 30 some years, that is what makes it a terror.
Did it blow you away that therapy actually worked?
Well, it's... Yeah.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to subscribe to The Carla Show for First Responders, Firefighters Edition to get exclusive segments of your favorite Carla Show guests and episodes. Visit carlashow.com/firefighters and click subscribe to premiere. This clinically based psychoeducational training is a paid subscription due to its graphic content, which contains detailed descriptions of trauma that are not suitable for all audiences. Invest in yourself and take back your life. Subscribe and join Carla's network today.
The Carla Show.